And we should be live. Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you here to a special video session here with Michael Leibowitz from Real Investment Advisors. Hi, Michael. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Adam. Thanks for having me today.
Hey, thank you for joining us. Recently back from a trip to Europe. You look all fresh and bushy-tailed here. All right, folks. So this conversation is really going to be all about bonds. Bonds have had one of their worst years in forever, right along with the stock market. And it's a really interesting time, and I think important time for the regular investor to understand bonds well. And it's quite clear, especially from many of your comments, but you folks are not unique at all. A lot of regular investors don't feel confident in their understanding about how bonds work. There's math involved, not a ton, but enough to make, you know, most people feel a little uncertain doing that math in their heads. So Michael is going to demystify that for us here. And then, so he'll present for a little while, we'll talk, and then we'll take live Q&A from the audience here. The reason why bonds are an important topic right now is they are finally offering yields that are beginning to matter, which is something they have not been able to do for many, many years of suppressed low interest rates by the central banks. For a long time, people actually said there is no alternative versus being in risky stocks right now, because that's the only way you could get a real return. Well, now with, you know, safe bonds, treasury bonds yielding over 4% on the short end, there now is an alternative. So this is providing some new opportunities to investors that we want to make sure you understand. Also, given the bad year that bonds have had, one of the worst years for bonds, I think, Michael, in like hundreds of years. When they have a year this bad, there does tend to be some sort of reversion to the mean in following years. No guarantee, but that's certainly something that could happen here. So you have the benefit of getting both a yield with some option value too, of the actual value of the bonds moving up materially if we get a cooling off in interest rates here. So I'm going to let Michael go here in just a second. Two last things. One, Michael, if there's time, hopefully you can help folks just get a general understanding of how the dynamics of bonds might differ between the major classes, the sovereign bonds, the municipal bonds, and corporate bonds. And then folks, I just wanna let you know too, take whatever notes you want to here. Don't worry about scribbling everything down super fast, because this video will immediately after we finish this live discussion become a replay video here at the same channel at the same URL. So you'll be able to go back and rewatch it as many times as you like. And for those that are watching this on replay, welcome. Last, Michael, I just want to again express my thanks for you being here. And in the spirit of gratitude we all should have this week, happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving to you and everyone listening. So I think the best way to start this, we'll start at a very basic level and work our way into the different types of bonds and why bonds may be a great investment going forward. But to understand bonds, I think it's just best to start with the very basics. And I think the best way to do that is, what's the difference between a loan and a bond? I think we all understand what a loan is. A bond is essentially just a tradable version of a loan. So let's talk about a loan and kind of work our way up a ladder so we can have a better discussion of bonds. Adam comes to me and wants to borrow $100. I say, okay, Adam, you'll pay me 5% over the, and it's a one-year loan. He wants to borrow $100 for 1 year. So we agree 5% is the right interest rate for that loan. So on day one, I give Adam the $100. He takes it. About halfway through, he writes me a check for $2.50. That's half of the 5%. And then in a year, he's going to write me another check for $2.50 plus the $100 that I'll get repaid. So over the course of the 1 year, I would make 5% or $5 on the $100. A bond works the same, most bonds, not all bonds, but most bonds work the same exact way. The big difference is, as I said, between a loan and a bond is tradable. So what that means is that I lent Adam the money, but I could sell that asset to someone else. And there's that opens up opportunities within the bond world instead of being stuck with a loan on your books for a year. So when we talk about bonds and bond yields, there are two components. There's the coupon, which in our case is 5%. And now we've introduced a price because it's not a loan, it's a bond. So price is a percentage of what's called par value. So in our case, par value was the $100. I lent him $100. He paid me back $100. So the price at the initial offering would have been 100%. 100% of $100 is $100. So in our scenario, let's say that right now, Adam and I agree that I'm going to lend him in a bond, not a loan, but in a bond, the same exact deal, $100 at 5% for exactly 1 year. And we get off the phone, we shake hands, everything's good. 5 minutes later, for whatever reason, the yield that we should expect based on the marketplace drops to 4% instantaneously. Well, now all of a sudden I have something of value that no one else can get. Anyone else that wants a loan from Adam would now only get 4%. I got 5%. So someone comes up to me and says, Mike, I'll buy that loan from you. And I'd say, how much? And they go 100%. I'm like, no, I can, it's worth 1% more. So the right price, so the price of the bond has to change to reflect the yield change. So in our case, I would say, no, I want 101%. So a price of 101. So that basically means if you take 5% divided by 101, you're going to end up with a 4% yield. So because we're dealing with a 1 year bond, 1 year loan, the change in interest rate, more or less, there's some more complex math behind it, but as a very good rule, the change is 1-for-1. So if yields were to drop 2%, the price would go up 2% on day one. That changes as the term, as we eat into that 1 year period. So what makes holding bonds interesting is not the 5% coupon, but all of a sudden I made 1% overnight selling my bond to someone else at 101. So 1% in one day annualized is a huge return. Now, in our example, we're using a 1 year period. Let's pretend it was a 2 year period. And again, same terms, but it's 2 years. And yields drop instantaneously once we shake hands from 5% to 4%. The price would not go to 101, but it would go to 102. And if we had a 10-year loan, it would go from 100 to 110. So literally within seconds, I would have made 10% on my money. Now, bond yields don't move 1% at a time, not very often. It is an extremely, extremely rare move. But what it does show you is that there are two components to think about. One is the coupon and one is the price, and the price changes. And when you think about the total return on a bond portfolio, it's the combination of the potential price changes and the coupon that you will receive. So that I think hopefully provides a framework that we can start thinking about bonds as an asset that has a price like a stock and a dividend, a coupon, like a dividend. The big difference is that in 1 year, hopefully, Adam pays me back, or whoever I sold the bond to, the $100. So the price, assuming that the bond matures, will go from 100, and it'll vary up and down depending on what yields do, but it'll end at 100 exactly at maturity a year from now. So unlike a stock, which will start here and it'll go up and down and up and down, and it could end up high, it can end up low, could end anywhere. The bond, assuming that there is no default, will end at par at 100. So let's talk about the different types of bonds. Broadly speaking, you have U.S. Treasury bonds. Those are issued anywhere from 1 month securities out to 30 year. The shorter ones are called treasury bills, 1 month, 3 month treasury bills. Then they're called notes, a one-year note, a two-year note, a five-year note, seven-year note, 10-year note. And then we have 30-year bonds. They are all bonds, even though they're called bills and notes. And the Fed issues those regularly to help fund the deficits. And those are what the market believes to be risk-free. And we can debate this all day, whether risk-free or not, but the answer is the Fed and the Treasury will print money to make sure that they're risk-free, that they will always pay off. Then there's corporate bonds. This is when AT&T, IBM, Microsoft, Apple, you name the company, borrow money. These are rated, most often rated by credit agencies, anywhere from AAA, which is pretty much on par with the U.S. government, down to C minus. I think they even go to D for default. Everything triple B and above is considered investment grade. That should mature at par. But as you go from AAA to AA to single A to triple B and on down, the odds of default are increasing. So as someone that wants to buy a corporate bond or any type of bond other than a U.S. Treasury, we introduce a new factor into the bond, and that's default risk. So with Adam, let's say when we were doing the analysis and talking about our loan, that I understand that Adam's not doing well financially, that there's a little bit of a chance that he's going to default. I would want to price that into the bond. So I would say, Adam, I can't do 5%. I can buy a U.S. Treasury note at 4.5%. I want a 3% premium. So I want you to pay me 7.5%. So corporate bonds work the same way. Their yields are higher than U.S. Treasuries, and that yield differential reflects default risk. And one of the great monitors we can look at in the market are in the bond markets are credit spreads. So what's the difference between an Apple bond and a Treasury bond? What's the difference between a Ford bond and a Treasury bond, between a triple B and a Treasury bond? And that spread or the difference goes up and down over time, depending on what the economic outlook looks like, what risk tolerances are, and a number of other factors. So the other types of debt are, there's mortgage debt, which are a decent amount more complicated because they're backed by mortgages. And while Fannie, Freddie, Ginnie Mae loans are government guaranteed, the payment of principal comes every month in small amounts. And those loans can basically mature at any time as homeowners prepay their mortgages. If they sell, if they just want to prepay, if they decide to write an extra $5,000 into the mortgage payment. And there's foreign bonds and a whole host of other bonds. But, the important takeaway is that the risk of a bond is credit risk, the risk of default. It's interest rate risk. So the loan we did with Adam went up in price from par to 101. It could have easily gone down to 99. So how much interest rate exposure do I have? Again, the shorter the maturity, the shorter the term of the loan, the less interest rate risk I have. And so you have credit and interest rate risk. Credit is default risk. That's, based somewhat on the company you're dealing with and somewhat on the economy. Interest rate risk tends to be a function of inflation and economic activity. So what we've seen this year is inflation has gone sky high over the last year and a half, and the economy's been relatively strong. With that, yields have gone higher. Yes, the Fed is raising rates, but bond investors, 30-year bond investors, are not overly concerned with what the Fed is doing today, tomorrow. They're looking at a 30-year period. So what they want to protect themselves for is what's inflation going to be like for the next 30 years. And as bond yields rise, what they're telling you is that there's a concern that inflation will be higher than it has been. Now, conversely, what we're starting to see now is that the very aggressive Fed is actually friendly for long-term bonds, because the Fed is showing that they care about inflation, and they will do everything possible to get it down, including hurting the stock market, which is unheard of in the last 20 years. So, you know, the Fed can be friendly or unfriendly to bonds. And just because the Fed is friendly to 30-year bonds doesn't mean it's friendly to a one-year bond. A one-year bond is much more affected by inflation over the next year. And as such, it's going to be much more affected by what the Fed does with the Fed funds rate for the next year. So that was kind of a long-winded introduction to bonds with just a little bit of flavor about what's going on in the current environment. Adam, do you have any questions? Hello? Adam?
Sorry, I'm just talking there for the past 30 seconds, not realizing I was on mute. Thank you.
I was worried that I was speaking for the last 15 minutes to no one.
Sorry, didn't mean to put the fear of God in you there. Yes, I do have a lot of questions, and I see people are beginning to ask theirs as well in the live chat. So folks, as you have a question here for Michael, please just ask it there and I'll surface it here. But Michael, thanks. You did a really good job of describing bonds in simple terms, in language that I think most laymen could understand here. But I do have a couple of great questions for you. First is, you talked about the two types of risks, the credit, or default risk, and then the interest rate risk. Bonds have gotten beaten up a lot this year, largely because the Fed has been hiking rates super aggressively, right? In fact, the most aggressively than I think most living people have ever seen. As we begin to round the corner into 2023, do you have a sense for the degree of interest rate next year? I guess I'd posit it might be less than it was this year, because it's a little hard to imagine that the Fed is going to keep hiking at the rate it's been hiking, simply because the higher rates go, the more negative impacts that has on the economy. In fact, there's a lot of people that think the economy might not even be able to support the current rates that we have here, right? But I don't want to put words in your mouth. What do you think? Do you think that interest rate risk will moderate next year versus this year?
Absolutely. But I think there's a very, very important caveat that I should state, and pretty much every professional should state. I am 54 years old. I started trading bonds coming out of college in 1990. The last bout of inflation was 1982. I was in junior high or high school at the time. I remember the long gas lines, but I have no recollection of really what inflation, how damaging inflation was, and what it meant to the bond markets or even stock markets. I'm, almost 55. That means almost every professional, bond trader, stock trader, you name it, investment professional, has very little to no experience with trading stocks or bonds in an inflationary environment. So, I think that's an important thing that we should all recognize, that this is an environment unlike anything we've seen in 40 years. And that while we can form our expectations, we should also expect the unexpected. Now, that being said, the Fed is easing more aggressively, like you said, than they have since the late 70s, or early 80s. If you would have told me this a year and a half ago, that the Fed would be raising rates by 75 basis points four times in a row and getting the Fed funds rate up to 5% potentially or even higher, I would say you're crazy. But that's what they've done. And the Fed is intent on bringing inflation down. They don't want to get caught in the same traps they got caught in at multiple times during the 70s. So I do have confidence that the Fed will do what it takes to bring inflation down. And unfortunately, what that takes is likely higher unemployment and a recession. And you may say, well, the Fed's not going to put us in a recession. Well, the Fed is telling us that, it, you know, if you read through what they're telling us, and some of it is direct, they're not even parsing words. Some of it is direct. They intend to bring the unemployment rate higher. They will slow economic growth. They understand the risk for a recession is moderate to high right now. The Fed is willing to sacrifice jobs and willing to sacrifice the economy to make sure inflation doesn't stick around. So with that, you think about current interest rates. You could buy a 10-year treasury bond, no credit risk, at a yield of, it's a little bit under, but let's just say 4%. Prior to the last couple of years, inflation has been running 2% or lower. So when you think about bonds, you should be thinking about your real yield. What's your yield after inflation? So if inflation drops to 2% tomorrow and runs that way for 10 years, the real yield on a 10-year treasury note would be 2%. For the last 10 years, that number has been negative, not counting the last year or so. So the premium that we could potentially get for the next 10 years, if the Fed is successful in getting inflation back down to 2%, is significant. So as long as the Fed keeps up the fight and is willing to put this economy into a recession and is willing to raise the unemployment rate, I think they will be successful in getting inflation much lower, which should be very good for bonds. For bond, it should bring bond yields down. And again, bond prices higher.
Okay. Yeah. And just to underscore, nobody has a crystal ball on exactly what's going to happen, but you and others are seeing the potential here for potentially really attractive period here for bonds, right? If what you think may happen actually indeed happens. And it's interesting. I sort of see this as one of those, got to come up with a better analogy for this, but you know, those dunking birds, drinking birds you'd see at the carnival or whatever, where they they tip over into the water, and then all of a sudden, you know, they hit some saturation point, and then they come back up, and then they right. just kind of oscillate between the two. And it feels like what the Fed is doing right now is it's raising interest rates because it needs to fight inflation, and it's hiking. And that's making the yields on the bonds attractive. So you're getting paid a nice yield now that you're getting into bonds. But at some point, likely one of two things is going to happen. Either it's going to get inflation under control, and then it'll be able eventually to start, you know, cooling off and maybe, you know, go back to bringing the interest rates down over time, right? At which point rates will start going down, but the value of the bonds will start going up. Or, and this is what a lot of other people's thesis is it's going to keep hiking until it breaks something badly. It's going to be forced to pivot to bring rates down. And at the same time, capital is going to be looking for safe haven. And one of the perceived safest assets on the planet is long-dated U.S. Treasury bonds. So you kind of have these two potential eventualities on the same side of the ledger in terms of what could happen that could pretty substantially bring bond prices up. So kind of what I'm underscoring here is bonds are beginning to pay you better and better in the immediate term, but they're coming with this option value that right. we can see multiple paths to getting to.
That's exactly right. And if the Fed, that's why I think the Fed is your friend if you are buying longer term, longer maturity bonds, because the Fed will break something. We are an economy that is overloaded with debt. And that debt doesn't pay for itself. We pay for that debt by rolling over debt. So you borrow money for 10 years and then it's time to pay it back. Well, in many cases, the debt is not paid back. A new loan is taken out for 10 years. So given our heavy, heavy reliance on debt at both the federal level, corporate level, and personal level, the economy cannot afford the tax of higher interest rates for long. And that's one reason the Fed is so intent to get inflation down so that they can get interest rates back down to levels that allow for that debt to be rolled over and not defaulted upon. So I feel like the Fed is willing and able to do its job, but in its course, it's probably going to break something, which, like you said, could drop yields suddenly as money gravitates towards the safety of bonds. And if it breaks something, and if the economy really starts fading, the potential for yields to drop significantly. You know, a 10-year bond at a percent lower in 3 months would not surprise me, or 6 months. And again, if we just work the basic math there, a 1% yield drop on the 10-year bond would be roughly a 10% price gain on top of whatever coupon you got for those few months. So, you know, the reward is a lot more than the 3.75% yield or the coupon that you see. The yield is, again, a function of price. And I think price will be the driver of bond total returns, you know, at least for the next 3 months to 2 years.
Okay. And right now we're kind of focused on sovereign bonds. Although what you're talking about, whatever happens with the rates, will also work similarly in the other categories of bonds.
Yes and no. You have to be really careful there. So, you know, let's look at a triple B bond or a double B bond, which we would call junk. What could happen, and what typically happens in a recession, is that credit spreads rise. So the premium that I wanted from Adam, where I wanted 7%, not 5%, that number goes from 5 to 7% because I fear default risk. So we could have a 10-year forward bond where the credit spread widens by a percent, the 10-year treasury drops by a percent. So essentially the forward bond yield went nowhere, while the 10-year treasury yield dropped by a percent. And in that case, you know, you would get your coupon on the forward bond, but no price appreciation. So,
Right. And sorry, just to chime in, I'll let you go, but that's exactly where I was going with this, which is the interest rate dynamics largely impact all types of bonds similarly, maybe not to the same extent, but lower interest rates basically will send the price of bonds higher. But then you have to factor in the credit risk, which is what you're talking about with these other forms of bonds. And that's where things get more complicated, as you're explaining.
Right. And that's where you have to look, am I being paid enough of a premium to take the risk? And right now, the answer is no. If you're looking at spreads in general, yes, there are bonds and we're buying bonds. There are good bonds where we're very comfortable that the credit risk is minimal at worst. But that's a big consideration, is that credit spreads blow out. By blow out, I mean that they rise. And right now, credit spreads are still very tight, meaning that they're very close to U.S. Treasury yields. So the premium you're getting paid to take credit risk is not worth it, given that the Fed is pushing us hard into a recession, given that the Fed wants us to be in a recession, and given that the odds of a recession are very high right now. So we are primarily focused on very good corporate names, very highly rated names, names that we're very comfortable with, and treasury paper.
Okay. So given those dynamics, you're saying, you know, this is a time to really look at the safe part of the bond spectrum here. All right. So, Michael, nobody knows what's going to happen, but for those people that are playing for the Fed's really going to break something, and it's going to be forced to pivot. And man, it's going to have to bring rates back down, you know, near the zero bound. Not saying that's going to happen, but if it did, kind of gut feel, what appreciation could that mean for the long dated treasuries?
So if you're looking at a 30-year bond, that's the longest the treasury issues, and the rate's, what, 4% today? Give or take a little. If that rate goes back down to 2%, it's basically a 2% times, not 30, but let's just say 25. That could be a 50% increase in price.
Okay.
So it's substantial.
Yeah, it's substantial. And that's, I'm seeing a lot of sort of institutional investors sort of waving a similar flag that I believe you're sort of waving right now, Michael. And again, I'm not saying you're claiming it is definitely going to happen, but that there is more potential for that type of a move on the long end of the treasury curve than we have seen very often, right? It's sort of, they're just sort of saying, hey, this is the planets are aligning where there could be a pretty big appreciation move here, and you're getting paid to wait in a safe vehicle.
Correct. Here, and it's important to understand that at these yields, not at 2%, but at these yields, the risk reward is not 50-50 anymore. As yields keep going up, more things are going to break. The economy will break down. It is so heavily dependent on debt that it can't afford higher interest rates. So, you know, kind of like what you said, Adam, the odds that interest rates go higher and price goes down, yes, it can happen. And they may, prices may continue to go down, yields go higher for another 3 months, but it all leads us more and more to the point where something breaks and yields drop like a rock. So, you know, I like to, you know, I think it's a good time to buy bonds, do your due diligence, understand the risks, and just put them away. Don't look at them. There's no need to look. They're going to mature at par. But in between now and then, there may be a chance to reap a substantial capital gain on top of that, you know, on top of that.
Okay. And Michael, as again, if what you think is most probable does indeed occur, the market sort of sniffs this out early, right? Meaning, let's say CPI, you know, drops really fast from here, or let's say something breaks. The market is not going to wait for the Fed to bring the interest rates back down to 2%. It's going to calculate that the Fed's going to do that. And a lot of the appreciation that we're expecting is going to happen relatively quickly. Is that an accurate statement?
I think so. But there's a lot of factors that drive bond prices, and it's not just inflation. So this year, we've seen a lot of foreign selling of bonds because countries like the European region, England, Japan are trying to support their currencies. And these countries hold a large amount. I think there's 7-8 trillion of U.S. Treasury bonds are held by foreign institutions. So what they have to do to support their currency is to sell the Treasury bonds and convert those dollars back to their, they're basically selling dollars and buying the yen or buying the euro. So there's been a lot of selling pressure from foreign institutions. So it's not, we can't just say that just because inflation goes to 1% or 2%, just because the economy cracks, that yields are going to drop, because there are a lot of different types of players. And there can be forced selling, even if things are attractive. We see that with stocks all the time. Stocks get to very attractive levels and they're still selling because people are losing money, tax losses, tax gains, all kinds of issues driving it. So that's what I'm saying. Do your due diligence. Be aware that there's a lot of risks that Adam and I are just not going to get to on this call today. But again, Lance and I are both kind of pounding the table that the odds favor bonds over the next, you know, call it 3 months to 9 months. And again, investing is a game of odds. We're never given 100% chance of winning odds. We have to take what's given to us. And when we get odds that are, you know, 70-30 as opposed to 50-50, that's a really good opportunity. But understand your risk and know when to get out of it if you're proven wrong.
Right. It's almost sort of like a Vegas, you know, card counter when you've been following the deck at blackjack and you're realizing, right, hey, probabilistically, I'm much more likely to get an ace here than I was earlier. So therefore, I'm going to put more chips on the table.
Right. I'm sitting on a 19 and the dealer just pulled a 5. I know he has to hit. I think he has a 15. Those odds are pretty good, but I've lost on that hand.
Right, right. So of course, you don't bet everything, but you're adjusting your bets based upon the probability.
Exactly.
So you raised one great question I want to ask in a second here. But real quick, back to my earlier question, the reason why I sort of asked about the timing of the reversal, right, when I was talking about that dunking bird, right, when all of a sudden the price of the bonds start going up because the market is saying, hey, I think, you know, rates are going to go down for whatever reason. It's the kind of thing where you have to be somewhat positioned in advance to take advantage of the majority of the swing. And again, I'm talking about probabilistically here. I just don't want people to be thinking, oh, okay, well, I'll wait for rates to come back down to 2 and then I'll jump in. Well, it's because you'll have missed a lot of the swing already.
Yeah, I mean, there is a potential that the move happens really fast. there's a potential it just happens slow and that you can leg into it over time. I mean, the fact is we just don't know. But if something breaks, it will be a pretty quick move. If this is just a function of inflation just gradually slowing down and the economy slowing down slowly, then it may just be a gradual move. But, you know, it's everyone's trading strategy is up to them. But I think given where yields are, first of all, you're being paid 4% if nothing happens. So right off the bat, you're at least getting paid something to take the risk. And even if price drops 4% a year, you're still breaking even at this point. That was certainly not the case when yields were at 1% or 2%. There was the potential, as we saw, to lose money. But those odds have shifted. So, you know, yes, I think it's important to have some bond exposure and think about adding when you're going to add more bond exposure.
Okay, good. And you mentioned a few minutes ago that one of the many dynamics that are influencing the bond market is buying and selling of foreign players. And there certainly have been a lot of big sovereign nations out there that have been selling their U.S. treasuries in a number of cases, sort of due to the whole dollar milkshake theory that we've been talking about, you know, on this program a lot, where they've been under pressure from the strong dollar. You know, again, nobody knows exactly what's going to happen with the dollar, but one would presume that at some point that selling, which has been higher than normal, will moderate at some point, especially if the dollar cools off for a bit here. So that's one more potential catalyst here, right? Could be either a reduction in selling or maybe even a flip to rebuying again by some of these players.
Correct. I mean, the reason the dollar, one of the reasons the dollar is so strong is because the Fed has been very, very aggressive against inflation and many other central banks have been very lackadaisical. Japan is still easing. So as you know, Europe and the UK are certainly getting a lot more aggressive and we're seeing that their currency rates are stabilizing. The euro is back up to what, 102, 103. It got down to 97 versus the dollar. So as you know, as the Fed starts to take their foot off the brake a little, and that doesn't mean they're going to ease, but it means they're not going to go 75, they're going to go 50 and then maybe 25 and then just let it sit there for a while Europe, the UK, other countries are still raising rates, that should, in theory, be better for the other currencies, meaning that they don't have to support their currency anymore. They don't have to sell bonds.
All right, good. All right, I've got a couple of questions here that folks have been asking. One here by Vijay is basically just asking, hey, you mentioned owning the 10-year versus the 30-year. Is 10 long enough? So what's the difference between the duration as you go out further? What's
risk
the impact you have as an investor?
Risk. So duration is the term that's used to describe risk. And you can think of duration as the change in price for change in yield. And in our simple example, we were saying that if the 10-year drops 1% in yield, the price should increase by about 10%. I think the real answer is about 9, 9.5, but the duration is in the low nines, so call it 9%. So the difference between owning the 10-year and the 30-year is price risk or price reward. If yields drop 1%, we could probably get a 9% gain in our 10-year bond and a 25, 27% gain in our 30-year bond. But conversely, if yields go up another percent, we're going to lose almost three times as much in our 30-year bond as a 10-year note. So it's a function of how much risk are you willing to take. And you can scale accordingly. Given that, you don't have to think about it as I have $100. Should I buy a 10-year or a 30-year? I have $100. Maybe I'll buy 100 of a 10-year, or maybe I'll just buy, making up a number here, 60 of a 30-year. That fits the risk profile I want, the risk reward profile I'm looking for.
Great. And you know, folks, I'll reiterate this near the end, but you know, what we're trying to do here is give you an exposure, again, sort of how the fundamentals of bonds and how they work and the math and whatnot. Don't worry if you don't feel like you understand all of it right now. One, you can come back and rewatch this video until it sinks in, but two, we're just trying to give you a sense of the context for which you can ask questions of your own professional financial advisor around this. So you don't have to shoulder the pressure of figuring all this out on your own. You know, if you're working with a professional financial advisor that understands this well, they can really be your guide, but we're hopefully arming you with enough perspective, context, and fundamental understanding that you can engage with them, you know, in an intelligent conversation about what options might be best for you, given your goals, your risk tolerance, that type of stuff. All right, Michael. So a number of questions that have come up have to deal with this, which is, okay, so how do I buy these things, right? And you can buy them directly, right, on the open market, or you can even buy, you know, the treasuries we're talking about straight from the U.S. Treasury via their treasurydirect.gov website. But there are also, you know, mutual funds out there. There are ETFs. What are the pros and cons of each? And, you know, what should people think about when they're trying to make this decision?
So you can buy from Treasury Direct, that you could set up an account. You can buy from their major custodians, Charles Schwab, Fidelity, TD. They all have the ability to easily buy and sell bonds. There's a question I get often. I get asked often, and someone will be looking at treasury bonds, say a two-year treasury note. And because the Fed's issuing them all the time, they come in different maturities. So what are we, November 22? So there may be a November 15, 2024 note and another November 30th, 2024 note. One has a very high coupon, one has a very low coupon, but the yields are about the same. So the question is, which bond do I buy? And what I always focus on is the yield. Focus on the yield, because that's going to be your return. Now, the question is, do you need income from the bond? If so, you want to go with the higher coupon payment, or are you irrelevant and you just want to earn that yield, at which point you go probably with the lower coupon to earn the yield. The other very important thing when you're looking at bonds, we haven't talked about it, but there's what's called callable bonds. So a callable bond, predominantly in the corporate bond space, allows the issuer to buy back their bonds at par. So if bond yields drop, it becomes more likely that a callable bond will be called. So you may buy a 10-year callable bond, but if yields drop significantly, they may call that bond in 2 years.
Yeah, and sorry to interrupt, Michael, but it's like an early repayment. Right, where right. They said, hey, we didn't expect the market to go this way. We don't want to be on the hook for this for the next 10 years. So we're just going to buy it back now.
Right. So they'll buy it back and reissue a note at the current yield, which is lower than that yield. So the important takeaway from this is you always want to look at, if you look at all the major brokerage custodians, they have a yield to maturity and a yield to worst. The yield to worst is your worst case scenario yield. That's if it gets called. So today you're going to find in most cases the yield to maturity and the yield to worst are the same, but that's something you should always look at and think about and understand whether you want to be called from the bond. You may just want to buy the 10-year and earn 4% for the next 10 years and don't care that the price may go up a lot over the next 2 years. You may just want to lock in 4% a year for 10 years. So if you have a callable bond, that may not happen. You may get called from that bond or paid back early on that bond.
Okay. And do sovereign bonds have callable provisions, or is it mostly?
They can. It's not as common, but they can. Okay. I don't think there are any treasuries. There may be, but I don't think there are any U.S. Okay. treasuries.
And when a bond is called, it's not that you're losing money on it. They're just taking away your ability to participate in this tasty opportunity going forward, right?
Right.
And they're buying it back.
They're buying it back at par at 100%. So, you know, when are they gonna buy a bond back? When it's priced over par. So if you have a bond at 102 and it's callable, they can buy it back at par. They're gonna do that. So it's a function of, can they call it? Most callable bonds have a date range in which they can call it. So it may be a 10-year callable bond, but they can't call it for the first 5 years. So it's just another wrinkle. And when you go on these major brokerage websites, you can usually set your parameters. You could say, I want something 3 to 5 years. I want AA or better. I want U.S. Treasuries only. I want callable or not callable. So make sure you kind of look at those parameters and make sure you understand what you're buying and what you want.
Okay. And you just said callable is a filter there. Absolutely. Are there instances in where you would prefer a callable bond?
If the yield, you know, if you're getting paid in the yield to take it, because
the yield is higher. All right.
You're selling an option to the company. So it's worth more to the company to issue a callable versus a non-callable.
All right. So another way to say that is if you're looking at two bonds and one is callable and one is not callable and they're comparable on every other dimension, as best you can tell, you want to make sure you're getting a higher yield on the callable one to consider it. If they're the same, you'd obviously go with the non-callable one, right?
Right.
Okay. We've been talking a lot about get into munis and ETFs. Munis.
Corporate. Right. So we were also, you can also buy bonds via a bond fund. And there are.
That's where I was going.
I forgot about that whole part of it. And munis, which we haven't discussed at all. But bond funds and ETFs have a purpose. So I may run a bond fund that's a 10-year corporate bond fund investment grade. What that means is that the maturities of the bonds I buy are between probably 8 and 12 years, and they have to be BBB rated or better. And I, as a professional bond manager, will manage that portfolio. Now, the one difference between you doing that and them doing that, besides them being the professional and this is what they do all day, is that they have to keep that 10-year maturity going. So as bonds start aging and they get down to 8 years or 7 years, they're going to sell those bonds and replace it with new 10-year or 12-year bonds. So there's a lot of buying and selling that goes on, both for trading opportunities, but also because they need to keep that maturity range the same. Whereas you may buy a 10-year bond and just let it mature all the way to zero. And that holds true for ETFs as well. The question, besides that factor, I think the big factor is, do I need that expertise? Do I want that expertise? And is the price I'm paying for it worth it? So you look at the expense ratios. A lot of the big like treasury ETFs have very low expense ratios. So in that case, I prefer buying the ETF versus buying the bond over for short holding periods, because it's easier, it's more liquid. Not that treasuries are not liquid, but they're more liquid in ETF form for individual investors. But those are some of the considerations when you're thinking about mutual funds or ETFs. And munis, we didn't talk about. Munis are like treasuries or corporates, but they're for municipal. There's a tax-free component, which you have to factor in. So the yield will be lower, but you need to factor in your federal tax rate into that yield and come up with what they call a treasury equivalent yield. So it's basically a yield after the tax benefit. There are many types of munis based on where the revenue is going to come from. It's complicated in its own way, just like mortgages are complicated. But because of the tax benefit, there is plenty of opportunity there too. And muni default rates tend to be much lower than corporate default rates.
Okay, so on the risk spectrum, you generally have sovereign safest from a default standpoint, then munis, then corporates, right?
Right.
You mentioned tax for a second too. Real quick, tax treatment of U.S. treasuries?
Fully taxable.
Are they, I know certain government bonds like I-bonds, for example, are exempt from state and local taxes. Do you know if...
I should too. I am unsure.
Okay. We'll double check that. On the muni side of things, a lot of the tax benefits there, I believe, is that they're exempt from, are they exempt from state and local taxes as well? Because you're basically...
If you're in that state, so if you're resident, if you're a resident of that state.
Yeah. So with munis, you rightly said they're kind of like mortgages in the sense that like you have to take the individual borrower and the location and the type of structure into account. You know, it's one thing to buy a treasury bond, especially if you're a U.S. resident buying a U.S. treasury because it's America. You know what America is. It's one entity. When you're looking at the muni landscape, you have to ask yourself, okay, how well is this municipality running itself, right? So there's lots of people that say, I would never buy a muni bond in, say, Illinois, because they've got a lot of issues there, right? But I might buy one in, I don't know, you know, Beverly Hills, because we know their coffers are super well funded. I just made that, that reference up. But anyways, so I can see you've got something to say on this.
No, I was just going to say that may be an area, munis, where you do want to buy a fund and, you know, a fund or an ETF. And they do have mutual funds for individual states. So I could buy a Maryland municipal bond fund that holds just Maryland or a large, large percentage of Maryland bonds. So I get that state tax break as well. But I have a professional going through all these bonds. I mean, I personally know the state of Maryland, the fiscal situation, and I have a good understanding of the county I'm in. But there's 23 counties in Maryland, of which I can really only talk to about two or three of them as far as their fiscal whereabouts. So, you know, and that holds true for probably most of our listeners here. So that may be one area where you either stick to what you know, to stick to the county or the township or the state level, or you hire a professional via a mutual fund. Adam, are you on mute again?
Jesus, I am on mute. I did just do a quick Google search, which is why I was on mute. And it says most bonds issued by the U.S. Treasury are exempt from state and local taxes.
Okay,
it's most. So you do your due diligence here. I want to get to corporates in just a second. I do just want to say or clarify one thing on back to at least U.S. Treasury bonds. Which is here in the U.S., you can buy them directly from the U.S. government using Treasury Direct, like we just talked about. If you do, and you're holding the bond itself through through the Treasury Direct website, if at any point you decide, like let's say you buy a long-dated Treasury, like a 10 or a 30-year, but let's say tomorrow, for whatever reason, you decide that you want to sell it, you can then simply have that bond transferred from your Treasury Direct account to your brokerage account and sell it in the open market, correct?
I believe so. I've never used a Treasury Direct account. So okay. I honestly don't know how it works.
I do. I've never made the transfer, but it's my deep understanding that you can do it and that it's relatively straightforward. And I just want to mention it for folks so that you don't feel like, oh, if I'm buying it from the Treasury, that I'm just stuck holding it to maturity. No, you can sell it in the open market, or if you're buying shorter dated bonds, especially T-bills, those things just keep renewing, or you just tell the Treasury, hey, you know, when it comes up for renewal, don't renew it. Just send me back my principal at the end of it.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So now let's get to corporates, which is, I'm going to presume, where the largest degree of risk is. I presume that means that's also where the largest potential return is, true?
Yes and no. So right now you have an Apple bonds that are trading pretty close to Treasury bonds. Its price, given that its price and yield are going to move up and down with Treasury bonds. So its upside is very limited because no one will ever buy an Apple bond the odds of Apple bonds yielding something lower than Treasury bonds are slim to none. So its potential upside versus Treasuries is very minimal. Is there risk in Apple bonds? Probably not, right? They're going to mature. So I think of an Apple bond almost like a treasury bond, as far as the risk reward spectrum goes. It's predominantly interest rate risk, not credit risk. Then you can move all the way down to Coinbase. Coinbase bonds. Coinbase has a 2027 bond, so called a 5-year bond, maybe 26, 4-year bond, that's trading at 50 cents on the dollar, and it has a coupon, I think, of 3.75 or 3.875, somewhere in that vicinity. That's a very risky bond. But it has a yield of 15%. So you're getting paid a risk premium of over 10% to take chances that Coinbase stays in business for the next 5 years. So you can't really characterize corporates as being more risky or less risky. It's like stocks. There's all different kinds of stocks. Some are very, very risky. Some are really not risky at all. You have to understand what you're buying, what potentially can go wrong, what can go right, and kind of base your judgment on that, your decisions on that.
Yeah, what I'm trying to help people think of is it's sort of like it's the risk return spectrum, right? So your likelihood of making a lot more money in a speculative growth stock is higher than owning a utility, but your likelihood of losing all your money too is a lot higher, right?
Right. Now there's one thing there's so much to unpack here, and we keep bringing up new stuff that's probably confusing, but there's a pecking order when a company defaults on where the assets, once you pay off some of the liabilities, who gets the money. Bondholders are first, stockholders are last. So often when a company defaults, bondholders don't get zero. They get something. They, anywhere from 10, 20, 30, 40 cents on the dollar. Lehman Brothers bondholders got something. I forgot what it was. I want to say it was like 15 cents or 20 cents. So your risk is not that it goes to zero. A stock can go to zero. Lehman Brothers went to zero, the stock, but the bondholders got something back. So when you look at Coinbase, you say my reward is that it goes back to 100 and it matures. Your risk is not that it goes to zero. I don't know what the default value of Coinbase would be, but let's just say it goes to 25 cents. So you may be risking 25 cents versus making 50 cents. However, if they go to default, there's no telling when you'll get that money. They don't owe it to you at maturity. They owe it to you after all the lawyers have divvied it up and figured out who gets what. But it is an important distinction between a stock and a bond.
Very good. That's the whole point of seniority. It's very important there. I'm glad you brought it up. All right. So, folks, a couple quick things. First, I meant to say this earlier, but if you are enjoying this deep dive into bonds, please let us know in the live chat here or in the comments below. Because if you guys like this type of exploration, deep exploration, we'll do this for other topics. And if it turns out there are other topics you'd like to see a deep dive like this on, again, please let us know in the live chat, the comments. We listen to these very closely, and whatever seems popular, we'll roll out as the next one of these. Also, do us a favor too, if you haven't already, just hit the like button. And if you're new here, click the subscribe button and the little bell icon right next to it. Those both support this channel well. Michael, there's a question here. We're coming up on the hour. I'm going to go a little bit over if that's okay with you.
Keep going. I got all day for you, Adam.
All right, good. And look, folks, we know that we're still scratching the surface of the iceberg here around bonds. We're not going to get to every question, but we're hopefully giving you enough understanding to know what questions you want to ask your financial professional about, potentially adding bonds to your portfolio here. Vijay asks about, if you're really pretty bullish about what could happen with the long bond here, are there ways to get more speculative on it? In this case, he says, are there options like stocks possible on the Treasury 30 years? I think he basically means, like, can you buy call options on these types of instruments? I know the answer to this is yes, not necessarily on the bond itself, but on some of these ETFs. What else would you answer to here?
So yeah, you could buy like a call option on TLT, for instance. You can also trade futures. There's bond futures, which like stock futures are leveraged. So depending on how much leverage there is, you can potentially earn a lot more than that 10 or 20% we were talking about. And I guess you could buy a bond using margin at your brokerage account as well, which would just further lever it up. And there's different types of, you could buy a 30-year bond with a coupon, but there's also what's called zeros. They don't pay a coupon. It's just the price is issued at, say, 70 cents on the dollar and it matures at par. So they have a higher, a 30-year zero bond has a higher duration than a 30-year high coupon bond, for instance. So you'd get a little bit more bang for the buck there as well.
That is interesting. I hadn't thought about the zeros. So they're a little bit richer in terms of the discount they give you at purchase because they're not paying a coupon throughout the life?
Right. That is the coupon. The coupon is the price. So they may issue it at 50 cents on the dollar. It'll mature at 100. The question is, what path does it take to get from 50 to 100?
Right. So let's deconstruct this for people. I'm going to reveal a trade that I have made, which is largely out of character for me because I'm not a very speculative guy. But I did take a little bit of money, and this is not personal financial advice, and I bought some leaps on TLT. So if you could do three things, Michael, if you could describe to people what a leap is, if you could talk about the logic behind buying a leap on TLT, and then maybe answer the question is, maybe if I was really swinging for the fences here, should I have tried to find an ETF that was invested in zeros versus TLT?
Let me start with that last one. I think there is one. I think I want to say it's TRZO or TROZ, Treasury Zeros. There's also EDV, Edward David Victor, which buys 30-year. They're closer to 30-year bonds. TLT, I believe, is a 20-year average maturity. So there are ETFs that do extend the duration more. As far as options, leaps are just long-term options. So I don't know what your term was, but it's probably doesn't expire for at least a year.
It was a year. Yeah. These were January 2024s.
Right. So what Adam's making a bet on is where the price of TLT will be a year from now. Now, like everything else, that price will change between here and there. But he is paying a option price for that. I mean, that should be options should be a whole other options explained simply segment you do, Adam. But basically,
sorry to interrupt, but I just want to let you know, we just did a deep dive into options, really using them as a hedging technique, but we do explain the fundamentals of how they work. So folks, if you want to watch that, I'll put this in the live chat, but just go to wealthion.com/options hedging. It's funny you mentioned that, Michael, because we literally did this about a week ago.
Gotcha. So right off the bat, if you were to say, well, is Adam's trade smarter or not? I it's hard to answer because I don't know things like time and volatility that I'm sure you guys talked about on that presentation, what he paid. If volatility is very high, he's probably paying a high price for those options, and it may or may not be worth it. But certainly leaps or even just calls going out to February, March, April, May, somewhere in there, may also have a lot of value. There, like anything else, there's numerous ways to play it safely with leverage. They're very liquid instruments and very user friendly, even for retail investors.
Okay, great. Thanks. And just a reminder, folks, again, that is not personal financial advice at all right now. If you're going to do something that speculative, definitely do it under the guidance of a professional financial advisor. And I did in making this trade. I will say too, and this is not to get anyone excited about the trade, TLT has been really beaten up this year. As Lance and I talk about almost every week, Michael, I think it went lower than most people thought it could this year, which tells you what a bad year it was for bonds. I bought those leaps back when TLT was in the mid 90s. As of the day we're talking here, it's back above 100. I think it's actually back above 101 right now.
Right.
It's nice to see that that trade is now in the green, because it wasn't for a little while. but if any of the things that you think might happen, place the trade because of the logic that you laid out at the beginning of this discussion, Michael, about what could happen. Now, folks, I have much more just in treasuries themselves. This is a little sliver of my exposure to treasuries. I just wanted a little kicker on the edge of the portfolio in case my general thesis paid off here. Go ahead.
But really quick, it's also a nice hedge. So if something breaks, there is the potential that bond yields can go much lower. Something breaking could be the stock market breaking, could be the stock market dropping significantly. So if you have a portfolio of stocks and bonds, in that scenario, bonds may do very well, helping offset some losses you may have in the stock market. The other thing, I meant to say this earlier, when you said, well, how else can I get exposure to interest rates? Some stocks have exposure to interest rates. Some have more exposure than others. So higher dividend stocks tend to have a little more exposure. Things like REITs have exposure. You can buy closed-end mutual funds, which certainly have exposure. So there are, and the financial sector has exposure not just to rates, but where interest rates are in relationship to each other, what we call the yield curve. So there are many different ways that you can, quote unquote, play what you think will happen with bond yields.
Yeah, it's funny. We just keep coming up with potential topics to do one of these deep dives on, right? Which is, okay, right. What are all the ways to play a change in direction of rates? Related to that, I'll ask just for your sort of 60 seconds on this, because again, this could be its own deep dive, or perhaps part of a larger deep dive, which would just be income investing, right? Which is something that's been very hard to do over the past 10 years, just because so many instruments that used to offer yields didn't. But we're now getting to the point where you can actually build a portfolio that begins to generate income that is, beginning to become material again, which is great for a lot of investors, especially older ones. But this question here is just from Steve. Any insight into preferred stocks? So can you just sort of compare and contrast owning bonds versus owning a preferred?
A preferred is sort of a hybrid. It's an equity structure, but it looks like a bond. Most preferreds are issued at $25, and they're either callable or ultimately mature at 25. Some are perpetual, meaning they don't mature. When we talked about the pecking order before, bonds are first, preferreds are second, stocks are third. Now, there's other things that go in between them, too. But preferreds are kind of a unique asset that will trade with stocks at times, will trade with bonds at times. I think certainly there is some opportunities. One of the tougher parts with preferreds is that a large percentage of the issuance is done by banks, which have their own unique, it's tough to analyze banks because of their bookkeeping is just very different from most other companies. So if you're buying a preferred ETF, there's going to be a large chunk of financial institution exposure in there, for better or worse. It may be what you want. It may not be what you want. But we hold preferreds from time to time. We like, we think there's a place in a portfolio for preferreds at times. And you can pick up, in the current market, 6-8% yields. And if you're buying something like a JP Morgan preferred, it's kind of like the Apple bond. What are the odds that JP Morgan goes under? Will the Fed even let JP Morgan go under? So there certainly it's another avenue, many avenues to play the bond story with.
Okay. So, Michael, thank you. This has been great. There's just more and more questions coming in, but I'm realizing that we'll just stay here all day if we do. Let me just ask you this. So sort of in closing, historically, people have said, hey, run a 60-40 portfolio. I know that that's what you guys do at RIA. It's much more complicated than just that. And Lance has been very good about telling us, why and when he's overweight or underweight part of that balance. But I guess my question is, bonds have been heavily subject to the intervention of the central banks since the global financial crisis, right? They just shoved interest rates down to historic lows. I mean, literally, in some cases, people have said rates we haven't seen in thousands of years, right? And we have tons of negative yielding debt elsewhere in the world. And so you could make money on the appreciation of your bonds, but for so many people, especially retirees who were planning on retiring with the income that they were going to get on their portfolio, it just threw those people under the bus, right? They couldn't get any income. And so they were forced to go chase yield out on the risk curve, which we're now seeing this year. It's a very destructive thing to force people to do at that stage in their lives, right? So nobody knows for sure what the future is going to hold, but now bonds are beginning to yield more again. There's some chatter of the folks I talk to who talk to the central planners who say, kind of ZIRP and QE, we probably aren't going to go back to that because central banks are realizing that created this everything asset bubble and it created a bunch of wealth disparity and it may be hurting more than it's helping. Looking forward, do you see us potentially entering a new era here where bonds will be a more sort of nutritious part of a portfolio going forward than they've been?
The thing you have to consider is kind of that longer term macro problem that there's too much debt. So if bonds become, the 3-5% yielding instruments that I think you're talking about, that's a big tax on the economy that it now has to pay that additional 1-2%. And there's more debt than there is economic than the size of the economy. So it's a little bit outsized. So, can it happen? Sure. But it's another tax on the economy, which is just at the end of the day, deflationary, which will get investors, again, we're looking at what matters is really the real yield, how much you get after inflation. So if inflation, which used to run about 1.5 up to 2%, is only going to be running at 0.5% to 1%. Yields are even more attractive at 4%, but they'll probably go all the way back down to 1% because investors will take that all day, the positive real yield. So I think it's hard to see a scenario where interest rates stay at 3.5%, 4%, 4.5% purely because the economy cannot handle it. At least the economy today cannot handle that.
Okay. Well said. Well, that underscores two things. One is perhaps this attractive and maybe not super long-lived period in time where the upside in bonds seems higher than normal, right? And we talked about that earlier at the beginning of this conversation as to why now may be a really good time to be looking at these longer dated government bonds. But it also underscores why you want to work with a financial professional who really tracks all this really closely. And can be basically calling audibles on the fly based upon what's going on in the macro side of things to know when to dial up and dial down bond exposure for the reasons you just mentioned there, Michael.
Right. Nothing's risk-free. So, everything, even though I'm very bullish, Lance is very bullish, you appear very bullish on bonds, there are risks and there are things that we think about all the time that could derail our optimism.
Great. Yeah. An important reminder. At the end of the day, it's all about probabilities and playing to the probabilities and risk management. So, all right, folks, I'm going to mention a couple of free resources here. quick reminder on the one I already mentioned, which is if you're interested in learning more about the basics of how options work, and in particular, how to use options as a risk management tool, specifically for hedging against downside risk in your portfolio, go to wealthion.com/optionshedging. I just put the URL in the live chat there as well. That'd be a great video to watch after this one if you haven't seen it yet. But, you know, as you heard me mention several times during this program, you know, bonds, they are trickier for the average investor to get their brain around. Hopefully we've given you a good sense of the opportunities that are out there right now, as well as some of the risks to keep in mind. But hopefully we've made you smart enough to have an intelligent discussion about this with your financial advisor. And if you don't have a good one, or even if you do, but you'd like a second opinion of one that does understand bonds well as all the macro risks that we've talked about here, maybe even Michael and Lance and their team at RIA, just go to wealthion.com and fill out the short form there to set up a free consultation with these guys. Doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to work with them. It's literally just a public service they offer to help educate people and help people make smarter decisions. You can take what you learned. You can talk about it with your own advisor. You can implement it yourself. Or if you like these guys, you can continue talking with them. All right, just a preview of a couple of great conversations coming up this week after this one that we just had here with Michael. Had a wonderful conversation, really fascinating conversation, really honestly kind of blood boiling conversation with Ted Seidel yesterday. Ted is one of the foremost experts in the US pension system. He's won the largest whistleblower award for unveiling pension fraud. So we do a really good deep dive as well into the current state of the pension system here in the U.S. and in several other countries as well. And I will tell you, folks, the spoiler alert part of it is Ted saying, look, if you are counting on a pension going forward, you need to start doing some preparation in your mind for perhaps not getting everything that you've been promised. If that's of any strong interest to you, definitely watch that video coming out tomorrow. And then on Thanksgiving, Thursday this week, Thanksgiving here in the US, Thursday and Friday, we'll have our part one and part two interview with the legendary investor, Jim Rogers. And if you like Jim, he does not disappoint. So be sure to catch those as well. Hopefully while you're digesting your turkey, you'll have plenty of time to watch those videos. Also, just to everybody here in the spirit of gratitude, thank you all for being such great supporters of this channel. Michael, I want to give my gratitude to you as one of the key experts that comes on here. Thanks for everything you do, but in particular, thanks for coming on this week, which my pleasure. I know is a holiday week for you, and giving so much of your insight to folks here. Total pleasure. So happy Thanksgiving to everybody. And in closing here, if you can please help support this channel, just click the like button as well as hitting the subscribe button below and that little bell icon next to it if you're new on this channel. And as I said, if you'd like to see more of these deep dives, let us know in the comment section. And if there's particular topics you'd like to see, maybe it's income investing, maybe it's, you know, a deep dive into preferreds or whatever, let us know and we'll listen closer to that. Michael, just one last time, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Adam.
Okay, hope to do this again soon. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.